Welcome to NASS Dialogues, the dialogue podcast focused on events and issues in school psychology. I'm Dan Florell, the NASS online communication coordinator and moderator of our current dialogue. Today we're discussing a forever family, fostering change one child at a time, and we have the pleasure of having Rob Shearer with us from Comfort Cases, a nonprofit. And Rob, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we'll go ahead and start off by really talking about why you felt the need to start a nonprofit and to eliminate trash bags from the foster care system.
I mean, first of all, you just say the word trash bags and kids, and you know, we all should know that we need change within our system. For me, as a kid who grew up in the system, I remember the trash bag. And then to fast forward to having four of my children arrive 11 years ago, all carrying a trash bag from the foster care system, I just couldn't believe that we as a nation, as a country, who feel that we give so much, we can't even think about something like giving hope and dignity to a youth that enters foster care. So about 6 years ago, I was with my family. We were doing our yearly toy drive that we did every year. It was something big. We would set up a big tent in front of Ben's Chili Bowl, and people would come and drop off bikes, and all for the needy kids. And this one particular year, my husband Reese came into my office to prepare for it, and I said, I don't want to do it this year. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, what are we teaching our children? We're teaching our kids that for one day a year, you give the needy kid a toy, and you make a difference. I said, are we really making a difference? And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to eliminate trash bags. And at that time, I wanted to eliminate trash bags in D.C. I just was, you know, I'm a corporate guy. I had no desire to have a nonprofit. But what I did have a desire was to teach my children how to be better humans, to teach my kids that it's our responsibility that no matter what our past was, that we can make someone's future brighter. So we decided to put some cases together. Every single case has a brand new pair of pajamas. Each child gets a toothbrush, they get their own lotion, their own shampoo, and their own bar of soap. You know, I have people all over the country who say to me, I never thought about a bar of soap before. You know, I tell everyone who's listening to this podcast, go to a hotel, ask them to leave the bar of soap from the people in the room before you. Get in the shower and use it. I know you won't, because it's called dignity. Every day, we see 700 children entering foster care. Every single day, they go into a bathroom, into a bathtub, into a shower, and they're supposed to use the exact same bar of soap of, by the way, strangers. That's just not acceptable. We also then make sure that every child gets an activity. Kids who are under the age of 10, they get a pen and pencil and a coloring book and crayons. Kids over the age of 10 get a journal and a pen and pencil set. 2 years ago, I was filming a CNN special, and there was a 13-year-old boy, and he opened up his case, and he started to pull out his items and started to cry. And I went over and I knelt down, and I asked him why he was crying. He said, Mr. Rob, he said, I have been in foster care for 7 years. I've been in 11 homes. Every home I walk into, I have all this music in my mind. He says, the only thing I've ever wanted, and he pulled out his journal, was a journal to write it in. You know, my friend, that was a 50-cent composition book. But to that boy, it was his future. To that boy, it was gold. To that boy, we made him realize he matters. And then we give every kid a book. I truly believe that education separates each and every one of us on so many levels. And I believe that we must get kids to love to read at a very early age. I never remember owning a book. And I feel that as an author, we write books for two reasons. I wrote my book because, one, I want you to love it in your mind. Number two, I want you to love it in your heart. But the most flattering thing you could ever do for an author is pass a book on. We believe that there's no such thing as a used book. It's only a book that's been loved. And then we give every kid a blanket. My son Grayson was 6 years old when we started this charity. He'd come to us when he was two. His mother was 12. He came to us with bleeding of the brain, shaken baby syndrome, and three broken ribs. But at the age of six, he looks at me and says, Daddy, we must make sure that every kid gets a blankie. I said, Grayson, a blanket? I said, you know these kids aren't cold. He said, no, Daddy. Every time they wrap themselves up in their blankie, they know we love them. See, at the end of the day, that's all we want. You want to be loved. I want to be loved. We want to matter. So that's a comfort case.
So as a professor, of all the wonderful things that you were talking about in a comfort case, I'm curious as how the books are selected. Are they, kind of used books that you find, or are there particular ones that you give generically, or is it kind of somehow specific to the child, if you know that much about those who receive these?
So we're a 95% volunteer-ran charity. Mm-hmm. We have given out over 100,000 cases in all 50 states, D.C., and Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And our books are actually chosen by our volunteers. Mm-hmm. We have donations all over the country, books that come in. Again, it is the only item that is in the case that we consider not brand new. Mm-hmm. We do get lots of donations from Barnes & Noble, and we have a select group of books. There are a couple of things that my husband and I have always laid down, like a rule that we want when it comes to books. Mm-hmm. Number one, we will never allow a book in the title to have the word mom or dad. We do not need to remind these kids every single day that their mom or their dad is not in the picture. Mm-hmm. Number two, we use no books that have any religious, levels whatsoever. That is not our job to do that.
Right.
So, other than that, we do it all by grade level and mm-hmm. by age. When a kid gets a comfort case, the only thing we really know is normally what size pajamas they wear and they're male or female. So based on the size of pajamas, we'll be based on the actual appropriate book that we give them. And again, we give books from birth all the way up to age 19.
Okay, so yeah, quite a variety of books, it sounds like.
We have thousands. We have a warehouse in Rockville, Maryland, and where we pack our cases and ship them, and you would be amazed at the books that we have. And a lot of books that we get in that we cannot use, we then redonate them. We mm-hmm. redonate them to Title I schools.
Oh, okay.
We have just started a program with an amazing woman who had to go to the laundromat because her dryer had broke. And she went into the laundromat, and she saw all of these kids. And she thought to herself, I've got to do something about this. And one thing that she thought about as a teacher, that they needed books in that, laundromat.
Mm-hmm.
So now she does that throughout the D.C. area.
Oh,
and
cool.
We are so lucky that we donate books to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is they go to the laundromat and these kids can take them home.
Right.
Again, we must teach kids at a younger age that reading is enjoyable.
Well, and not to mention, the other literature beyond the foster care system, of course, is, the more books that we can have a child surrounded by, the better outcomes from reading. And, of course, then it also sparks that human connection, I would imagine, which is incredibly important in the bonding process of, especially among foster care, I would imagine, as homes are changed, unfortunately, fairly frequently.
Yeah, they really are, and it's sad for the kids. We must understand that kids who are in the system didn't choose to be in the system.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the system because of choices that other people made.
Right.
And we need to keep their life as normal as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like we have forgotten these kids. I mean, there's 438,000 children that are sitting in our foster care system today.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that 30,000 of them are going to age out this year, and 70% of them will be homeless within 2 years, just like I was as a kid when I aged out,
mm-hmm.
it's unacceptable.
Right.
We must open the opportunities for these kids. And I will have to agree with you that starting them out young, reading, it does open up their future. I look at my son who just came into our house last year, and he's 19, and he's been in the system for years, house after house after house. And all he needed was a really firm foundation.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, he's graduating in June with a 3.6.
Oh, that's great.
And to know this boy's story, you would say, how did he get that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know how he got it, because he loves to read.
Mm. Yeah, so important. Now, you've already kind of talked about and elucidated a few of the difficulties that we have with the current foster care system, but I was curious as if you could elaborate a little bit more. I mean, we certainly have talked about some of the mobility issues, and sometimes that perception of lack of respect, which is what sparked your whole idea here with the nonprofit. But if you want to elaborate a little bit more on some of the difficulties we're seeing in our foster care system.
Well, first of all, we have to realize the fact that our foster care system is not broken. We hear that all the time. We see that in documents. We see that in news articles. It's not broken. It's, it's shattered. Broken things, my boys bring me the super glue and daddy will put it back together.
Right.
But when something is shattered, it has to be rebuilt, and it has to be rebuilt from the ground up. Most people are really surprised by my answer when it comes to foster care. I wish that we didn't have it, and I wish we didn't have it because I wish that we would do better by keeping families intact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have five kids, and all five of my kids arrived through the foster care system. And without that system, would I have been able to be a dad? And I think about that. But I also know that we see over 64% of kids who are taken from their family from the word neglect.
Mm-hmm.
Neglect. And I will tell you, your definition of neglect and my definition of neglect is probably really different. And let's talk about that latest article that most people have read about, and it's been on all the social media, about the mother who had five children.
Mm-hmm.
Five children, and in the middle of the night, her new baby was hungry. I don't know if you've read that article, but her baby was hungry. And so she couldn't get a hold of any family member. And so instead, she called 911. 911 arrived and brought her formula. By the way, I will remind you that that woman was a white woman. If that was a black woman in the Harlem area of New York, all five of those kids would have been taken, and they would have been sitting across from a table with a therapist, because they would have considered that a form of neglect.
Mm-hmm.
See, neglect truly is a racial issue. It's an economic issue, and we need to stop that. And for me, it's about building families, for us coming together as a community and realizing what we lack. And what we lack is compassion. What we lack is doing what our forefathers expected us to do, which is to help each other out. If I'm hungry and you have a piece of bread, you should share it with me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're hungry and I have a piece of bread, I should share it with you. We've forgotten that along the way. And so I see this system completely shattered. I mm-hmm. see this system not getting any better. I see this system is in a system that makes money on the backs of children. And a lot of people don't agree with me, and I'm okay with that. This is my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's my 53 years of living within the system. It's my five children who I have walked this walk with them from the system, and I see how shattered it is. It was shattered in the 70s when I walked into the system, just like it's shattered in 2020 when my son walked into my home.
Well, I imagine when you talk about those who are in foster care, in many cases, it's kind of a voiceless population, right? You have children under the age, by law, have very few rights. As you say, very few advocates for you. I mean, fortunately, you're involved, but you're one. And how many did you say were in the nation? 400,000, something like that. And so I can see where, you know, when you have a system like that, it takes the rare individual to go ahead and draw attention to it and then try to make those changes. And so I'm curious, and I think, once again, you've alluded to a little bit, but how you would change the foster care system. And I obviously, you know, you've talking about maybe broader brush strokes, but are there more specifics that you would recommend for those who are listening here?
Well, first of all, yes, and definitely. And I'm very opinionated by this.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that when I walked into this, I didn't want to tell my story. I had kept my story a secret for many years. Only very few close family and friends knew about my story
mm-hmm.
because I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed about what you would think. I was embarrassed the fact that I didn't have all these letters behind my name, and I didn't know the difference between there, there, and there. But what I did know is that I needed to be a good human. And to be a good human, I needed to tell my story, because my story could lift one person up. And so for me, telling my story changed everything. But what it didn't change is the fact that we still are not educated enough about our foster care system.
Mm-hmm.
So the couple of things that I would immediately change is, number one, I would set these kids up for financial success.
Mm-hmm.
Financial success. You know, most people don't realize, but foster families, parents who decide to be foster parents, they receive a stipend every single month. In some states, that stipend is up to $1,000, and there's no requirement to put any of that money aside for the child.
Mm.
I think that we need to take a portion of that stipend, and we need to put it in an interest-bearing savings account for these kids the moment they walk into the system. I'm not saying write them a check when they age out,
mm-hmm.
but give them a net. Give them the first month's rent on an apartment, a down payment on a car. If they want to go to school, have some type of spending money. We literally set these kids up for failure when it comes to finances.
Right.
The next thing that we need to do is we need to open up the education pathways. And I do not mean by what everyone sees on social media, where a new governor has signed a bill that foster children get free tuition. Mm-hmm. That's all bullshit, okay? We have to realize that these kids need complete educational services. Mm-hmm. That means we need to think about their housing. We need to think about their mental state. We need to think about what happens when the school closes during the wintertime.
Right.
You know, that happens. And we have actually seen that, where kids who are in the system, who are trying to get an education, who are at a college, and the college shuts down during the Christmas holiday, those kids end up in a shelter. Once you enter a shelter life, it is really difficult to get out, mm-hmm. you know? So those are two things immediately we could do throughout our country. I mean, I don't think you realize, or most people don't realize, is that we have a national system that does not talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So no state talks to another state.
Right.
In our state of Maryland, we barely just got our counties to talk to each other. If a child enters the system in the state of Florida, there's barely any effort to see if there's any living relatives throughout the country. We should have a national database. But when these kids enter, first thing we should do is, number one, try to find a next of kin.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do that. You know, I believe that when kids enter the system, every judge, every social worker, every attorney should ask four questions. Number one, can you take the perpetrator out of the house and not remove the child?
Mm-hmm.
Why disrupt the child? Can we remove the perpetrator? Number two, have we looked for anyone to come and live in the house to stabilize it, to stabilize the family, to be there for the support that they need? Number three, what have we done to remove the child and go with the next of kin? And then the fourth thing that no one seems to ask is, have we really seen what we could do as a community to lift the family up, mm-hmm. instead of taking the family apart?
Right.
I understand that when you raise a hand to a child and you make a mark on a child, or that you harm a child, the child needs to leave the situation immediately. But you also have to understand that we have over 64% of kids who are just taken because of the word neglect.
Mm-hmm.
Not abuse, neglect. That right there could change so much if we just looked at those things.
Well, and I will say, I would ordinarily be a little bit ignorant about the foster care system, but I live in Kentucky, and the governor there, whatever you might think of him, did put a huge emphasis in revamping the foster care system. And of course, it's far from perfect, because there's a lot of work to do, but a lot of the issues you bring up are very same things. You know, there was like a lack of funding if it went to a family member, whereas if they were in strangers, they would get funding. And that just makes no sense at all if you're, you know, you're giving it to a family member who it's going to be a real financial strain to take another mouth to feed. Yet it's going to be the most ideal situation, hopefully, in keeping the child within the family and hopefully with somebody that's relatively familiar to them, versus the whole switching of all of the things that they know. I mean, all of us have a very difficult time in trying to transition to brand new settings, and to continually be set in a system to do that on top of, you're just a developing person yourself, so you got plenty of change going on top of that. I can certainly see how disruptive and how much of a struggle it's going to be for them to even be able to overcome that and show that resiliency that we know a lot of children do have.
Well, you know, I will tell you, first of all, I absolutely love the governor of Kentucky, mm-hmm. and I don't care what your party line is.
Right.
By the way, kids in foster care, they don't care if you're blue or red. What they care about is that you make sure that they matter. I know about the governor's story. I know about the playground where he met the daughter. Mm. I know.
I
follow him. And again, he's one person who's truly trying to make change.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that if we all come together and try to bring this throughout our nation, just, gosh, could you imagine what we could do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all need to realize that we're all on the same island, and the island is to make a child's life better. You know, I always think about it this time of year as we're getting ready to go for graduations, and
mm-hmm.
I get to actually experience that with one of my sons. But only 54% of kids in foster care graduate from high school,
mm-hmm.
only 54%. The fact that only 11% apply to college, and that only 3% get a four-year degree, wouldn't that tell you right there we have failed?
Right.
If that happened in your community, in your county, if that was your school district that was showing a report of only 54% of the kids graduating from high school, mm-hmm. you know what we would do. We as parents would be protesting and picketing. But we do this with kids in our system every day, and nobody says a word.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to my prior comment about a kind of silent population, and we know that regardless of the various populations, the silent ones are the ones that get overlooked, and you have to have somebody who's advocating for them and raising that. To borrow from a previous podcast, be a disruptor, right?
I like that, by the way. Yeah, I'm going to remember that. I like that.
Byron McClure, I'm going to give him the shout out for that, and he was talking about the school-to-prison pipeline, but once again, a silent population, and yet a very high level of concern for that particular issue. Not that that's what we're focused on here.
But you have to look at the statistics for kids in the prison population. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, 2 out of 3 kids in foster care are going to be dead or in jail. Simple as that. 2 out of 3. So just think about that number. And then think about the fact that there's been studies to show that a little over 60% of males who are in our prison population have actually been touched by foster care.
Mm-hmm.
60%.
That's amazing.
Even if you're at 4, I mean, that's crazy to say the only thing that we're doing is we're graduating these kids from foster care to the penitentiary. That's
right.
It.
Yeah, and it boils down to, and even though they're different life circumstances, that, you know, when you have a chaotic childhood, whether by your choosing or not, usually not, whether it's the family you're associated with or just events that are beyond your control, that does not set one up for good development. And so your efforts are a small part of trying to provide that stability back to those children. And regardless of whether you're in foster care or you are some child that's growing up in poverty and a broken family, all of those are going to give you high risk, and you're not going to have the outcomes. And of course, you know, in our society, prevention gets ignored, and you know, consequences get emphasized. And unfortunately, we have a lot of really large prisons. And where I live, it's an overpopulated prison system where nobody's going to get any better, or we could spend the money that we're throwing away in prisons and, you know, do the right thing, and so that next generation has the possibilities, right?
I agree.
I teach child development.
Oh my gosh!
So I mean, you know, you're talking my language here. We've been going on about a lot of the issues in the current foster care system. Is there anything else, you'd want the larger public to be aware of before we go on?
You know, first of all, I want everybody to know that these kids do not belong to me. They do not belong to you, but they do belong to us. They belong to us. And I think so many times we're so worried about our own backyard, but we don't realize that our community is not our zip code. It's our human race. And if we give a better future to these kids, it does make our future better.
Mm-hmm.
You made the comment about the prison population. You know, could you imagine that if we actually got the graduation rate up for these kids, how our future could be? We have no idea what these kids are capable of, because immediately we as a country consider them disposable children. Mm-hmm. We do consider them disposable children. And the reason I say that is there's 4,600. I hashtag 4,600 because of an amazing friend of mine who made me aware of the fact that as of right now, we are counting 4,600 kids in the United States that are missing. Missing.
Hmm.
They are considered AWOL, but they're missing. We've been able to determine that child trafficking, 80% of it, is kids from foster care.
Hmm.
Why don't we see these kids on a milk carton? Why don't we see these kids on a billboard? My children would be on a milk carton. They would be on a billboard. These kids deserve to be found as well. Mm-hmm. And so again, we're just in a community that just doesn't seem to understand that these kids matter. You know, I tell people all the time, it's not about another case for me, but it's about giving a voice to a child to let them know, I see you, and you do have a voice, and speak up. I have people all over the world who reach out to me from foster care who say, I didn't think I could tell my story. I didn't think that it mattered. I didn't think anyone wanted to hear me. And mm-hmm. I say, we do want to hear you. We want to come together. I do see some change, and I'm loving the change that I see, but I'm also loving the fact that I hear kids who are aging out have a voice finally.
That's terrific. Of course, you know, we talked a little bit about the prison implications. We've talked about children going missing. But some of the other hidden costs are in regards to the longer term mental health. And obviously, our audience is more school psychologists. And so we are painfully aware of a lot of children who have current mental health issues. But then, of course, as they age out and the various challenges that they unlikely have the coping skills to deal with, what are some of those things that you're seeing as far as the longer-term mental health issues?
Well, the biggest issue that we're seeing is that we're not addressing these children's mental health issues from the beginning. See, I'm a firm believer that therapy is the best thing in the world. Mm-hmm. I go to therapy, my family goes to therapy, and each one of my children go to therapy, and I'm proud to say that, you know, because the fact is that I came with a lot of baggage. You know, coming into the system when I was 12 years old, coming from a father who used to put his cigarettes out on me, you know, the abuse that I went through as a little boy, and then to turn 18 as a senior in high school and become homeless, living on the streets of Northern Virginia, I came in this world with a lot of baggage, and I would not expect that baggage to be dealt with just by me alone. Mm-hmm. But I tried to do that. From the time I was 18 until I was 34, I just tried to self-medicate myself, you know, try to do all the things that I thought was, but when in fact I needed medication, I needed a therapist. And I think that we don't do that with our children when they enter the system. Mm-hmm. You know, kids who enter the system immediately should go into therapy. No doubt. There's no questions asked. You know, and the fact is we don't, I don't want a social worker to say whether or not a child needs to go in therapy. As you stated, if a child is taken from their home, they're upheaval. Their whole life is just like a juggling act. Mm-hmm. They need to speak to someone that they can talk to. As I'm seeing older kids now and talking to the older kids who have aged out, the problem is that they don't have health benefits.
Right.
So they're not able to get the help that they need. There was a young girl that I just read who's reached out to me on social media, and it broke my heart because she couldn't afford the meds. Mm-hmm. That she knew that needed to stabilize her. We've got to be better at this. You know, we have to understand that mental health is something that should be on the forefront of every single person. It truly is. And mm-hmm. I think that as a country, we're still at a point where we're still ashamed of it.
Right.
You know, I'm not ashamed of the fact that I have to take medication to make sure that I don't fall into that well that I know so well. That's deep and dark. Mm-hmm. I know about it. I have to do that. And I'm not embarrassed about that. And I don't want my children to be embarrassed. I have a son who suffers from depression. At a very young age, we realized it. And I talk to him all the time because I want him to realize that it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. So we have to do a better job, my friend.
Right. And I agree. There is certainly stigma. But then we also have, unfortunately, the reality of you know, who's paying for these services. And of course, is it a penny wise, pound foolish kind of policy? Like, yes, it costs money up front to provide mental health services to our foster care children. But if they're well-adjusted adults, guess what? They're going to contribute to helping the next generation versus having to take away from all the other services of the police, the prisons, and everything else that we have to provide to them. And yet, in the current environment anyway, that is not the mentality. There's lots of talk about, oh, look at the mental health. But for those of us who work in schools, we're painfully aware that the resources are just inadequate. And even if they were adequate, it would be hard to reach out to all those children that still need mental health. And so I don't know if you have any resources that are available for foster care children that are not maybe the immediate in-person, but maybe organizations, many like yours or others that you're aware of that could be helpful in at least making a little bit of a difference towards the longer-term mental health.
You know, there's a lot of amazing nonprofits that are out there that are trying to make a difference in foster care, mm-hmm. you know, trying to mentor children, trying to make sure that kids are you know, receiving something when they age out. But I have to say, this is my sixth year in this arena, and I never thought that I would move behind a desk. And, you know, I enjoyed being an executive. And but now that I do what I do now as a public speaker and to travel the country, I've yet to meet anyone that has brought up anything about these kids' mental health. It just, we don't talk about it. And again, mm-hmm. do we not talk about it because, you know we don't have the funds? You know, it's the same story I say all the time. I hear people say, oh my gosh, the social workers are overworked and underpaid. Well, they always have been, mm-hmm. and so have teachers, and we seem not to care about that. And it's once again a population of kids that are disposable, and we just don't seem to get that. And by the way, you know, I think about it all the time when it comes to my five children, that, you know, if they had not have an opportunity to have two white dads to live in a dominating white area, would they have the opportunities that they have for their mental health? Mm-hmm. That we're getting for them. And I know that's not true.
Right.
You know, I know that, you know, I look at my children and what they've gone through at a young age, that, you know, how that's affected them now, you know. And something I have to say that I don't tell people this often, you know, I deal with mental health every single day, not for just me, but I have a son who is 12 years old. He is the light of my life. And he's been living in a residential facility for the last 3 months mm-hmm. because he wants to take his life, because he cuts himself, because his anger is so uncontrollable. I love my son, and I want him home. But if my husband and I weren't able to give him the ability to go to a facility that he's in right now, where would he have fallen through?
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult as a dad. It's difficult as any parent. But to be able to talk about it and to know that, you know what, I know we're doing the right thing for our son, I think we all need to start realizing that mental health affects each and every one of us on so many different levels.
Mm. And so for those who are listening, and, you know, as school psychologists, we're painfully aware of the mental health challenges, not just with the foster care population, but just in general, and trying to make a dent into it. And, of course, a lot of models now have developed to try to do some prevention efforts to spread around, give good skills, even though it's probably not as intensive as what's going to be needed for a child that's gone through a lot that usually results in them ending up in foster care. So do you have some advice on how communities might be able to help children in foster care? I know you've talked about, you know, we need to care for each other. We're all part of the human race. We're all part of us. But what in your immediate community can you do?
Get involved. Get involved. You know, we do not see the involvement. You know, I go to group homes throughout the country, right here in my backyard. I don't see the involvement. I don't see our community stepping up and tutoring these kids. I don't see them coming over, read a book to them, you know, shoot some basketball with them. Well, mm-hmm. I'm not a sports person. Okay, then sit down and talk to them. Talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine what it would be like if we just talked to them and let them talk to us? You know, I get tired of hearing people say they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what to do. We need to step up and be there. Go find. You know, I know that adoption and foster care is not for everybody. But the fact is that everybody can volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody can mentor on some type of level. I get it. We're all busy. Nobody's busier than I am. But I will tell you, I take every single moment I can. If I can lift up a child, if I can lift up someone, that's what I'm supposed to be here for. But I tell the people who are listening, you know, one, educate yourself about foster care within your community,
mm-hmm.
you know, wherever you can go. And then go find a group home, you know, get certified to go mentor one of these kids. You know, right here in Maryland, we have a boys' home, and most people don't even realize it. Mm. It sits in a beautiful part of Maryland, one of the most expensive places in this particular area. This zip code is the highest it is, sits right in there. Mm. I go there quite often. There's a young group of boys that live there. Nobody talks about them. Nobody goes and visits them, and it breaks my heart because I look at their faces, and I know that they're going to be a part of a statistic,
mm-hmm.
a statistic, because we just didn't take time to make sure that they know they matter.
Well, I'm curious, as you're talking, you know, and what your opinion is on why that is. I mean, we have an awful lot of outreaches for a variety of populations, and yet we don't with foster care. And I can tell you one of my theories is, you know, is it somehow that they are the stain from the failures of the adults? And are we acknowledging, if we're lifting up those other people's mistakes, that we are wiping those parents' mistakes away? And, you know, we're an eye for an eye culture in many ways. And so is it a reflection of that? Is it a reflection of something shameful, you know, and we don't want to recognize it? I'm curious to see what you think about that.
So I kind of, first of all, I love the way you put that, because I do believe that it's all of the above. Mm-hmm. First of all, foster care is not warm and fuzzy. It's not. I mean, as I said, these kids come with baggage. And, you know, we have such a misconception of foster care that it's only bad kids. Mm-hmm. Fact is, there's no such thing as a bad kid. It's only a kid that needs to be redirected. And so we have in our head that these are bad children. Mm-hmm. But in fact, these are children that are in a system because of choices, as I said, other people made. And I think as a community, we are just not educated about it. We really do think this, and I ask people all the time, what do you think happens to kids in foster care? Tell me what their day is like. Tell me what you think. Who takes care of them? I'm shocked at the number of people who said, I thought our government took care of everything. I thought these kids didn't want for anything. I thought that they were in loving foster homes. And by the way, there are lots of great mm-hmm. homes, but we have to realize that there are a lot of bad homes too.
True.
You know, I was just giving a speech at a conference for social workers, and there was a couple social workers after I gave my speech who came up to me afterwards, and they said, we are one of those social workers. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, you talk about the fact of social workers who have put children in homes that they wouldn't even left their pet. And I said, why would you do that? And they said, because we don't have enough beds.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have enough beds. You know, the fact is that, you know, I think about it all the time. When my four children arrived, I was done with four. That was it. And so little would I know that last year, after giving a speech, that a young boy would walk up to me and tell me his story. And now I consider him my son. He lives with us. The fact is I think that we should dig down deep and realize what difference we can make within our community for these kids.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I think that we all can do something.
Okay. So, you know, we talked more generally about what we can do in the larger community and to help. I'm curious as to maybe a little bit more specifics about comfort cases and some of the impact that you've seen with your organization on foster care.
Well, you know, the fact is that we've seen a huge difference. And what I mean by that is just 2 weeks ago in Fort Wayne, Indiana, mm-hmm. the mayor signed a proclamation of no more trash bags, that they are no longer going to allow trash bags in Fort Wayne for children in foster care. And so that's a huge impact. Mm-hmm. We've had that same impact here in Montgomery County, where in Maryland, where we actually deliver cases on call. And we have an amazing government in our county that has said, no more trash bags. We're seeing that also in other areas of Texas, where people are doing proclamations and social workers are making the commitment. We also are seeing kids who are stepping up and who are saying, as a trash bag is being handed to them, you know what? I know of this gray-haired man who's in Darnestown, Maryland, who said, I don't deserve this, mm-hmm. that I deserve more. And they're reaching out and they're getting comfort cases. You know, we also have a program called a Comfort XL, which mm-hmm. is a 32-inch duffel bag. We started this program about 3 years ago, and it's a duffel bag that folds up in about the size of a book.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we give every child one of these duffel bags, but then we also give them to police officers and we put them in the back of their trunks. You know, I got an email this morning from an amazing police officer in Maine who told me the story of going to a home and having to remove a child. And the only thing that was there was trash bags. But he had Comfort XLs in his trunk. And he was able to go out to his trunk and get one of these Comfort XLs and remove this child with dignity, you know, with his duffel bag and not in a trash bag.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the impacts we're seeing. We're hearing police officers saying what a difference we're making. We're hearing social workers saying what a difference we're making. We're hearing judges say, I've heard about your organization. You're mm-hmm. making a difference. The thing is that we're one organization that, you know, is 95% volunteer ran. Mm-hmm. We survive because of our volunteers and the donations of people all over the world. But I do believe that in my lifetime, I'm going to see somebody step up and say, you know what, Rob, no more trash bags in our country. And then I want to walk on the steps of Capitol Hill and I want to drop a trash bag. And I want to look at all of those people who work there for me, work there for you, and say, you know what? This is how you get things done. You bring a country together, you tell them and educate them about a problem, and then you solve it.
Mm-hmm.
You solve it. And we can solve this issue.
Well, that's terrific, and it's a great organization and a well-needed focus on a topic that, as you say, is often neglected. Do you have any last thoughts for us as we begin to wrap up our podcast today?
You know, I would like everybody to visit our website at comfortcases.org, you know, see what we're doing. The fact that we've given out over 100,000 cases and still going strong, I think it's important that we all need to do something. And again, at the end of the day, I don't really care what you all do. I tell my kids this all the time, be a doer, be a mm-hmm. doer. You know, I have a daughter who has no desire to do anything when it comes to our charity, but she loves horses. And so she will go volunteer at a horse farm. And mm-hmm. that's good because we need to raise our kids to be doers. You know, it's how the world goes around. And
right.
so, you know, I tell people, just be a good human. Remember that. Remember that that child that you help today is your future tomorrow. So thank you for this amazing opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome, and it was our pleasure. That was Rob Scheer of Comfort Cases, and that's going to conclude this Dialogues podcast. Please tune in again for future Dialogue podcasts available on the NASP website.